Thank you so much for attending. We've had some great talks so far, and for my presentation, we're going to switch gears a little bit and really focus on how genetics may shape some of the risk for addiction, as well as response to some of these medication-assisted therapies that we've been hearing about. And so I have one disclosure. I do work for a commercial entity. Millennium Health is a service provider for some of this pharmacogenetic testing that we will be touching on, and I am a principal investigator for Millennium Research Institute. So ideally, when you guys walk away from this presentation, you'll have a sense of how genetics can help shape, again, not just the risk for developing various substance use disorders, but potentially how differences in our genetic makeup from one person to another can actually impact how you're going to respond to medications. And this is clear from medications across the spectrum of therapeutic indications. And of course, addiction and medication-assisted therapy and addiction is one of these areas where a lot of research is now being done to try and understand how genetics could be impacting response to, for example, methadone, naltrexone, suboxone is also one frequently used medication, and so studies are looking at whether or not changes from one person to another could be due to underlying genetics. So I won't belabor the statistics on this slide. I think we're all very familiar with the data that this is showing. Clearly, in the U.S., illicit drug use is rising, as well as particularly prescription drug abuse. This is 2013 data, so not the most frequent or not the most recent data, but as you can see, there's about 5,500 new initiates per day in 2013 that were exposed to one of these different illicit medications or a prescription drug. However, it's really interesting to note that not all 1,500 or 5,500 went on to develop addiction. Just like if all of us in this room later tonight decide we're going to have a steak dinner with extra salt, not all of us are going to go on and develop hypertension, right? And in fact, we can use the hypertension analogy to really tease out some more similarities between addiction, which is a brain disease, and again, chronic illnesses like hypertension, which is a cardiovascular disease. Both have environmental triggers that can lead to symptoms and can lead to development of each of the diseases. Both do have medications and medications that are used to treat the symptoms. And unfortunately, both have individuals or patients who are receiving medications not necessarily adherent or compliant. In fact, both have about a 50% rate of non-adherence to medications and compliance with that regimen. Both also have a pretty strong genetic component. With addiction, there's about a 30 to 60% genetic risk, right? So your genetic loading is only about half of your risk for addiction. The other half is environment, which is no surprise. And there's been an extensive amount of work that has been done to try to tease out exactly what the genetic and environmental mediators are for overall addiction risk. What we know from at least the genetic studies is that it's not a monogenic or single gene phenomena, right? So if we look at Huntington's disease, which is also a complex disorder, we see that it's a single gene that leads to development of Huntington's. This is not the case, though, for addiction. And in fact, it's not the case for most complex diseases like depression, cardiovascular disease, any of these other chronic conditions that we deal with unfortunately, a high frequency, are not really attributed to a single gene. Instead, like addiction, the genetic influence is due to small, usually additive effects from a constellation, really, of genetic factors. So multiple genes that together or individually don't really have much of an effect, but combined can have a, again, synergistic or additive effect that can then lead to that risk for developing addiction. And then, of course, there's all the environmental factors, and those can be many, and those can be parsed out and, again, impact individuals and their relative risk differently. So when we think about the interaction, then, of genetics and environment, this matrix is useful to help us work through what the consequences may be and what those interactions may be. And this is very simplistic, but I think it's good to really understand a key takeaway from genetics and environment and their interactions with addiction risk. So if you look at the black box and the white box, those are really the very easiest cases in which it's pretty clear cut what the risk or relative risk of addiction is going to be for an individual. So let's just, for argument's sake, say that there are 100 genes that confer addiction risk, right? So just 100. That's not true. Don't leave this room and think that there's only 100. But for the sake of this example, let's assume there's 100, right? And there's a clear list of environmental factors that increases your risk of addiction. That individual in the black box has all 100 genetic risk factors and all of the environmental risk factors. And so their relative likelihood of developing addiction is pretty high, right? And so conversely, that white box, an individual that falls within that white box who has really none of the genetic risk factors and very few, if any, of the environmental risk factors, is very unlikely to develop addiction, even if exposed to illicit substances, even if they use them, right? Their risk, their relative risk is low. The challenge and the ambiguity comes in when we start looking at those gray boxes, right? And those are folks who have some amount of genetic loading and some amount of environmental loading. And what will really be important in those cases is exposure, right? You could have all of the genetic risk factors that could confer addiction, and none of the environmental risk factors, but if you have no exposure to any sort of illicit substance, you've never used any sort of substance, then you're unlikely to develop addiction, right? And vice versa. So it really becomes difficult then, and what's the point of this? The point of this is it becomes difficult to assign a very clear predictability to any genetic tests or markers right now, in terms of whether it can predict risk of addiction, right? So there's a lot of interest right now in trying to understand if we can actually use our genes to understand if an individual is more or less likely to develop addiction, right? And that's a very interesting area. It's a very hot topic of research. However, we inevitably run into this issue, right? And this is, I'm going to quiz you on this, so please take notes. But this is the issue of really complexity, right? It's an extremely complex phenotype, just as, again, many of these other chronic illnesses are. And so to tease out where the genetic variations are likely to lead to higher or lower risk is very challenging, particularly because it's not a monogenic disease. So, again, you can have all the genes that confer risk, but it depends also on your environment. And of course, in terms of candidates and candidate genes for risk markers for opioid addiction, it's really the usual suspects, right? Addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is primarily a dopaminergic dysfunction, right? And you've got many neurotransmitters involved, but again, dopamine is going to be a key player. And so dopaminergic receptors and variations within those receptors have been implicated in risk of addiction, as well as opioid receptors, which, again, makes sense. It's a newer or maybe less intuitive class of factors, which are essentially neurotrophic factors, that have also been implicated in addiction risk. And these are very interesting. So as an example, BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, it's actually a protective factor in your brain and really does work to prevent cellular degradation, cell death, again, neuroprotective effects. Some of these other proteins are involved, for example, in plastic synapticity, in memory, in making sure that when you are experiencing something, that is retained and that has certain associations within your brain and certain regions or domains within it. So lots of research that's emerging, but clearly still a lot further that we have to go before we can say that there's a definitive test that can tell you whether, you know, patient A versus patient B is more or less likely to develop addiction. Now, on the flip side, another area where genetics is becoming increasingly used is, again, to help understand response to medications in individuals that are being treated for addiction. Right, so these are individuals that could be treated with, for example, methadone, could be treated with naltrexone, Vivitrol or Revia, as well as Suboxone. And again, to make a very important message here is that it's not just the medication-assisted therapy for the primary addiction that is going to be important. It's also all of the medications used to treat their secondary or comorbid conditions. And we know that there's a lot of comorbidity with individuals who have substance use disorders. Depression, very frequent. Anxiety. So a whole host of other types of mental health disorders are going to come with that individual who has that primary addiction diagnosis. And so medications and the spectrum of medications and understanding response to those medications is going to be important. So with pharmacogenetic testing, there is somewhat of an idea that because of the actionability of some of this information, that it may be more useful in clinical practice now than, for example, tests that try and predict risk of addiction based on a person's genetic profile. So why would that be the case necessarily? Because we know that in terms of a response to a medication, there's clearly pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, and I'm a PhD in pharmaceutical sciences, so I throw these terms around and I could talk again on them for days and days, but I won't. What is important, though, to take away is that when we think about a medication, let's say an oral medication, in response to that medication, these two factors are going to be crucial. And these two factors, all of these processes within pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, are mediated by proteins. Right? And so if we're talking about proteins in the body, we're talking about genes and DNA. And so if there are differences in these DNA or protein in the proteins and the DNA underlying DNA sequence, then there may be differences in how those proteins function. Right. So if you've got a receptor, for example, the opioid receptor, OPRM1, and there are differences in the gene that codes for that receptor between one person and another, there could be potentially differences in how medications bind to OPRM1. For example, opioids. Or other types of agonists or antagonists like buprenorphine, like naltrexone, right? And so pharmacogenetics is really the study of how these differences in underlying genetic or DNA code of individuals in key proteins can potentially impact or change the response among individuals to medications. And this is not a new phenomenon, right? Raise your hand if in this room you've had a different response to, let's say, aspirin than maybe someone else you know, or you happen to have a preferred headache medication, right? Not everybody in this room uses Tylenol. Not everybody in this room uses aspirin. And that's a small example, but we can take it bigger. We can go to antidepressants. Right. We know antidepressant response is unfortunately unpredictable. Only about 1 in 2 individuals respond to a first-line agent. A lot of that does have to do with the genetic differences that are going to guide, for example, how you metabolize that drug, as well as the genetic differences in receptors, for example, serotonin receptors, that mediate the effects. So we're going to stick to enzymes for most of this, and that's because enzymes, what they do is really mediate the levels of the drug and its metabolite. And so it dictates how much of the active drug you have circulating in your system. We know there's a lot of genetic variability, and particularly in these CYP450s. What that means is that in this room, all of us are going to fall somewhere along this spectrum. Many of us are going to be what are called normal or extensive metabolizers. We're going to metabolize as you would expect, but there are going to be a number of us who are not going to have normal metabolism that may metabolize certain drugs either faster or slower than others. And it depends on ethnicity, right? We know from the data that having differences in metabolism rates can substantially impact certain outcomes. For example, number of drug switches, whether or not you have a poor or adequate response, as well as adverse drug reactions. And there's been, again, a whole host of studies that have been published looking at a variety of different medication classes. There's also FDA labeling, as well as published guidelines that can provide clinicians with information about how to use this pharmacogenetic information, whether you need to actually decrease the dose of a drug by 50%, or if you should consider an alternative based on whether or not that individual has a certain genetic variation. And I'm going to briefly run through two cases. I won't go into the details, but this is not a real patient, individual who is being treated for substance use disorders with methadone. Methadone is a very interesting medication because it comes, as we administer to patients, it comes as a racemic mixture, right? So essentially, methadone is comprised of two mirror image species, right? So it's like your hands, your left hand and your right hand. Methadone comes as R-methadone and S-methadone. The analgesia that folks can experience with methadone is due to the R-methadone. And that goes through a different metabolic pathway than the other species, which is S-methadone. We know, though, from published data that S-methadone can lead to the cardiotoxic effects that are possible with higher doses of methadone, for example, QT prolongation. And so you look at these two different racemic species, and they go through different metabolic pathways. And what we also know from the data is that certain genetic variations in one of the enzymatic pathways, in this case the one that actually leads to the cardiotoxicity, can be different from one person to the other. So genetic variations in this enzyme, CYP2B6, can mean that you are actually at higher or lower risk of developing QT prolongation. And just as a side note, we know clearly there's a lot of factors that can lead to your risk for QT prolongation, but this is certainly one of them and is genetic in nature. What the data does show us is that folks that are particularly what are called poor metabolizers for CYP2B6 not only have a higher risk of QT prolongation, and again, some of this data has actually come from postmortem studies, which are unfortunate, but also probably one of the clearest indications of a clinical association, and that particularly in the case of folks that are being treated for addiction with methadone may require lower doses, right? So they actually would do better on a lower dose compared to individuals who are normal metabolizers. And this has some clinical implications. If you've got an individual who's on methadone maintenance therapy, again, probably not something that most folks do, but split dosing may be an option for this individual because they, again, would do better on that lower dose, right? They also may not be necessarily a candidate for methadone given the QT prolongation risk. So it's important for that individual to evaluate other clinical factors that can increase their risk of QT prolongation, other types of medications that may be increasing that risk, and at that point decide whether or not methadone is actually a good option for that patient. And that's really the point of this type of information. So as sort of my parting slide, are we almost at the end? So as part of my parting slide, what I want to emphasize is that, again, when we think about genetics and addiction risk, we still have a long way to go. It's really not ready for prime time. But in terms of pharmacogenetic testing, at least for specific drugs and specific genes, there appear to be sufficient data to consider implementing it cautiously in clinical practice. And what we envision this information doing is really helping the clinician make medication decisions. So it's not a crystal ball, but what it can do is help the clinician make more objective and more informed decisions about dosing and about which medications to prescribe and which medications not to prescribe in certain individuals. Thank you so much.